I have a very bold claim that I think is utterly defensible, and in fact, I'm going to defend it. It's a claim that has to be set against the tortured and torturous counterclaim of the New Atheists that Christianity has done nothing for us in history. You so often hear Richard Dawkins, Michel Onfray, Christopher Hitchens, you know, whatever, add on, say stuff like, what has Christianity ever done for us? Apart from rape and pillage, of course, Christianity's done a great job at that. You read Hitchens' book and you think that's really all Christianity has ever done. There's no mention of the good stuff. In fact, what Hitchens tends to do is, in fact, they all do this as a rhetorical strategy, all the bad stuff, that's Christianity, all the good stuff, that was when, you know, the secular enlightenment came along. And there's a more sophisticated version of this that you sometimes hear in more academic circles, but you do see it in someone like Michel Onfray, who, being a Friedrich Nietzsche fan, loves to look back to the classical world, as Nietzsche himself did, and say all of the best values came from the classical world, the Greek and Roman world, before the rotten Christians came along and made it go pear-shaped. That was Nietzsche's view of world history and philosophy. And Michel Onfray does this. So there is this sort of attempt to say that all the good stuff in society hasn't come from Christianity. It's come either from the Enlightenment or from classical culture, Greek and Roman culture. I think you're going to be hearing this a lot more. Okay, so no matter how sort of arcane and complicated and slightly bizarre some of the stuff I'm going to be talking about may sound, I'm going to try and pause and give you summary statements that might be the only things you want to take away, but you're going to need this stuff. Maybe not all the details, and as I look back over the outline, I regret giving you some of the stuff that's there, but maybe, you know, over time you can sort of go through it and reflect on it, and it'll just be a hopefully a little storehouse of information. I'm going to present two test cases in which I'm going to demonstrate that things that seem self-evident societal goods in Western society were only possible because of the Judeo-Christian worldview. Okay? And this is charity, the notion of charitable gift-giving to the poor, and the very notion of empirical science. These both are possible only because of the Judeo-Christian worldview. Well, let me begin with the history of charity. I'm at point A already, so I just feel like it's swimming along. The history of charity. Here is a very interesting point. There was almost no charity that we would recognize in the Greek and Roman worlds. Almost no charity in the Greek and Roman worlds. The idea that charity is a classical virtue is indefensible. But what I want to do now is I want to take you through some texts and some very important arguments that demonstrate, in fact, not only was there no charity that we can really put our finger on, not on any large scale, but there were views in the ancient world. The way the Greeks and Romans looked at reality, in fact, prevented charity on any large scale. Okay, that's where we're going. And it kind of looks like this. If you glance down, here is one very important text from Plato's Laws. This is mature Plato. Okay, Plato is the big gun of philosophy. People revered him. This is his mature reflection on what a good society looks like. It's not like the earlier work, The Republic. This is a more practical work that unpacks what a good city functioning as a worthwhile society ought to enact as law. And one of the important pieces of legislation he would lay down for the good society is that poor people should be banned from the city. Okay? Which may sound a little puzzling, but his logic is that generally, poor people are poor because they deserve to be poor through sloth, through stupidity and so on. Though he does allow a category of a virtuous man who through misfortune entered into poverty, and he allows some care of that person. So if you glance down at the text, he says, the man who suffers from hunger or the like is not the man who deserves pity. Okay, so the general poor doesn't deserve pity. But he who, while possessing temperance or virtue of some sort, or a share thereof, gains in addition evil fortune, wherefore it would be a strange thing indeed if in a polity and state that is even moderately well organized, a man of this kind, be he slave or free man, should be so entirely neglected as to come to utter beggary. In other words, in a good ordered society, it's just unthinkable that someone would fall into beggary. Wherefore the lawgiver will be safe in enacting for such cases some such law as this. There shall be no beggar in our state. And if anyone attempts to beg and to collect a livelihood by ceaseless prayers, the market stewards shall expel him from the market, and the board of city stewards from the city, and from any other district he shall be driven across the border by the country stewards, to the end that the land may be wholly purged of such a creature. The interesting thing about Plato's laws is that they came to have quite an influence, it seems, on not only Greek legislation, but the Roman jurisprudence. And the way Romans thought about beggars comes in part from this text. Do you see his basic idea that although we allow some cases of virtuous people who may strike misfortune, we can show them some compassion, but generally the poor are to be expelled because really it's their own fault. Now, there are actually huge background ideas running Plato's view, and I want to give you a sense of this in a couple of other texts, but the ideas are these. The rationality, fixity, eternality, and balance of the physical universe. The ancient world believed that the universe as a whole was eternal and balanced and fixed and totally rational. The way they got there was the thought that, if I can put it like this, a piece of string is not logical, but a circle is. You see what I'm saying? So if there is just a continuation of time that is constantly changing, and the bits of creation are constantly changing as well, there is no order. And for the Greeks, order is primary. Logos is primary. So the creation, despite the fact that it looks like it's changing, can't actually change. It is fixed in a very real way. It is ordered according to logos, to rationality. Let me point you to this text by Chrysippus, 280 BC. He was a very famous philosopher who founded the Athens school with Zeno, the founder of the Stoic movement. And in this text, he'll give you an idea of what we're talking about. The Stoics say that when the planets return at certain fixed periods of time to the same relative positions in length and breadth, which they had at the beginning when the cosmos was first constituted, this produces the conflagration and destruction of everything which exists. Then again, the cosmos is restored anew in precisely similar arrangement as before. The stars again move in their orbits, each performing its revolution in the former period without any variation. Socrates and Plato and each individual man will live again with the same friends and fellow citizens. They will go through the same experiences and the same activities. Every city and village and field will be restored just as it was, and so on and so on and so on, to the minutest detail, he says. In other words, what we're experiencing now will happen again in a precisely the same kind of universe, down to the minutest detail. And it has to be this way, because if everything is just fluxing through time, there's no rational order. And rational order is primary for the Greek. So the only way to get around this problem of flux is to posit that everything happens exactly in the same way, that it is so ordered that this moment now corresponds to another exactly the same moment in the next cycle of time, on through infinity. There can be no true flux. Everything has to be rational and ordered. This is significant background thought for the Greek thinking about charity, because charity is changing the order of things. Okay? There is a fixed nature, and it is not ours to get in the way of the fixed ordered reality throughout the universe. Leaping 400 to 500 years later, we come to a very famous philosopher, Plotinus. Born AD 205. Very interesting character. I won't tell you any more about him because I'm just trying to focus on the essential material. But he's in Rome. He sets up a little philosophical club, a little kind of community, and has lots of very interesting thoughts. And he tries to grapple with this problem of the apparent change of things, not by saying everything will be exactly the same in the next cycle of time, but that everything in this cycle of time will find its balance, its mirror opposite in the next cycle of time. But I want you to see that he's trying to solve the same problem, that things are not just endlessly changing, they have their mirror reflection. So he begins at point 12 up there by talking about the Logos. If then the rational formative principle itself has by fitting itself into matter done these works, being the thing that it is, unlike its parts, I won't go on any further, but I just want you to see he's grappling with the idea of there being a fixed logos in the heart of the universe. And then look down at 13, where we read, then, this being the case, we must not discard the argument either, which says that the rational principle does not look only at the present on each occasion, but at the cycles of time before and also at the future, so as to determine men's worth from these and to change their positions, making slaves out of those who were masters before, if they were bad masters, and also because it is good for them this way. And if men have used wealth badly, making them poor, and for the good too, it is not without advantage to be poor, and causing those who have killed unjustly to be killed in their turn, unjustly as far as the doer of the deed is concerned, but justly as far as the concerns of the victim. And it brings that which is to suffer together to the same point with that which it is fit and ready to execute what that unjust killer is fated to endure. There is certainly no accident in a man's becoming a slave, nor is he taken prisoner by war by chance, nor is, and so on. Do you see his point? In order for me to hold that the universe is structured around a rational principle, I have to imagine that everything has its balance in the next cycle of time. Can you see how this affects, as a background thought, the notion of my helping a poor person? This is actually very similar to the problem you used to find in India. Okay, I understand things have changed dramatically in India, especially since Mahatma Gandhi. Tried to change the idea of a caste system. I know he wasn't able to do that entirely, but he did have some influence. And so there's a lot more sort of kindness between the castes in India. But Indians will tell you that caring for the poor was to actually go against the rational principle of the universe that has ordered them to reap the karma from their previous life. And you find a very similar idea in Plotinus, who's a Neoplatonic philosopher. But the similar ideas are driving both ideas, both outcomes. Excellent. I know I've always already confused people. But the big idea you need to grasp is that the ancient Greek view that the world is as it ought to be, as a rational whole for eternity, was a worldview that at least hindered my getting in the way by trying to relieve people out of the poverty that has rationally ordered them to be there. Okay? Doesn't mean people were never nice to each other. Don't try and exaggerate it in your mind. It doesn't mean there were occasions when people just felt human pity and did something about it. We're talking about macro things in society that prevented the notion of any structural charity. Here's another, moving over to 1.3. Delphi was an incredibly significant place in the ancient world, northwest of Athens. I'm not sure how many people have been to Delphi, but Delphi was regarded as the center of the earth. There was a great myth about two eagles being let free, one from the east, one from the west, and they met at this point in Delphi, the very centre of the earth. And it became the place of the great Delphic Oracle. You may have heard that people would go to Delphi. Both state leaders would go to Delphi and speak to the priests of Delphi and try and get some great wisdom. But private individuals would do it as well. And Delphi became this incredibly important place for wisdom. Now, there's a list of Delphic maxims, ethical maxims, that are regarded as the 147 most important ethical sayings of the great masters of Greece. Okay? It's a wonderful text for us because it takes us straight to what ancient Greeks valued above all else. And it's amazing to read this 147 maxims. I'm not actually going to do that right now, by the way. But if in your outline, I've given them all to you, okay, in the various recensions that we have them. But if we just start at one, just you get a sense of what I'm talking about. Follow God. Right? Why not? Okay. Obey a good man. Obey a good man. Obey the law. Worship the gods. Honor your parents. Yield to the just. Learn your lesson. Listen and learn. Number 8, know or recognize yourself. 9, mind to marry. You get the point, right? So there are all these sort of ethical maxims. Now, we've got to go all the way down to number 38 to get something. 38 is a very important Greek principle of ethics. Nothing to excess. Neither too much cruelty, neither too much passion. In Greek thought, compassion, that is my sort of weeping with the broken, is as disgraceful as my causing that brokenness. Both are excesses. I know that sounds really puzzling, but the Greeks so understood that the rational life is the only true life. And to be led by my emotions, either to cruelty or to pity, or a passionate pity at least, is to be an unstable man. Look, for the sake of time, I will let you read those later. I was going to draw your attention to just a few that come close to sort of the ethic that we would recognise. So like down at 93, look kindly on all. Okay, do you like that one? I like that one, look kindly on all. But that's about as close as you get to the kind of ethic you and I, if we were to draw up a list of 147 most important ethical maxims, how many times would things like love your enemy come in, or give money to the poor, or help the sick, or care for the dying come in? Quite a few times. You read 147 maxims from Delphi and you don't find anything about helping the poor. And I can't stress enough how important the Delphic maxims were in ancient Greek society. This is the collection of the seven masters of Greece. I often think, can you just imagine, you know, throwing a New Testament up in the air and just magically falling down and just picking up just a random 147 commands. How different it would look to the Delphic commands. Okay, let me speed this up. I'm at 1.4. The standard text that hasn't been surpassed, written in 1968, the standard text on charities and social aid in Greece and Rome is this one by Arthur Robinson Hands of University of London. It is still the textbook at university that you are pointed to because it was a massive study of about 1,000 years, 500 BC to AD 500, through all the Greek and Latin texts, looking for references to what we would call charity and social care. If you're a complete nerd, and I know there are a few of you in the audience, I can't recommend this book highly enough. But I've given you the cheats version in your outline. I've gone and grabbed the most important sentences from the whole book and shove them there for you. If you don't want to be a nerd and go and get the book, you've just got the words there. But let me tell you what his conclusions are. And so far as I know, he was not a Christian, just a very famous classicist, ancient historian. But here are his general conclusions. Firstly, reciprocity ruled ethics in the ancient world, including gift giving. Reciprocity in ancient life basically meant I will only do something for you on the understanding you'll do it for me. Okay? Why? Because that's balance. That's what's rational. That's what's appropriate. Yeah? And gift giving, Hans says, was driven by this reciprocity principle. So, yes, very often, benefactors would give money or grain to slaves. But there was always an expectation that the slaves would give back to the benefactor in terms of public honour. They would praise the benefactor in public, and perhaps knock out an inscription for the benefactor. Always reciprocity. Otherwise, you've upset the balance and the rational formative principle of the world. The other conclusion is that honour was gained through gift giving, and this was its normal motivation. I can't stress enough, and this is one of these background things that is essential to understand the ancient world. I can't stress enough how much the pursuit of honour drove everything. Honour was regarded as the greatest good. In fact, Aristotle said, honour is the greatest good. That is, you gathering to yourself public glory recognised by others is the greatest human good. And the ancients saw gift giving as a key way of gaining public honour. So much so that philotimia was the word, what we would call charity, but philotimia, phileo, love, timeo, to honour, philotimia. Acts of the love of honour is what Greeks called reaching into my pocket and giving you 20 bucks because you need it. Love of my honour. That's what it is. The alternative word is philodoxia, which is the same thing. It's just love of my glory. Does that sound difficult to get head around? The reason you're struggling with this is because of 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian history. One of the other conclusions is that Christianity, from its Jewish roots, repudiated the motif of gaining honour to yourself by gift-giving. Instead, they called for mercy, pity, compassion. That, on Greek logic, upset balance, actually. Because if the gift-giver receives no reward, if there's no reciprocity, either in honour or some other physical kickback, how is the universe balanced by this? If I just give and give, what's that about? But that's what the Christians thought. And they got it from their Jewish roots, from their Old Testament. The other conclusion that Hans comes to is that there were ancient hospitals in antiquity. They started, of course, on the battlefield and slowly made their way to the cities. But the hospitals we know of in Greece and Rome were available only to either soldiers or to the aristocracy and the immediate circle of aristocracy. And Hans concludes when he says, just looking at the last sentence in your outline on page 7, in the wealthy household indeed, medical care might on occasion be made available to the humbler members, judging by the generous concern of men like Cicero and Pliny for the well-being of their slaves and freedmen, or even to those of the household of an amicus, a friend. But scarcely in any case where no such personal relationship was involved. Okay, Hans does draw attention to the fact that there is a possible exception in the Stoic movement. The Stoics were a very, very thoughtful bunch and generally liked to be moral because they liked to live by the rational principles. And he does unpack that there was in some Stoic literature reference to caring for those in need. But here's the interesting thing, with no emotional attachment to those in need. You do it for rationality's sake, the Stoics said. Never weeping with those who are weeping. And I've given you the quote so you can read it for yourself. But this is very Buddhist, actually. Buddhists believe in compassion. But actually, compassion is completely the wrong English word. Because compassion means passion connected with someone else, right? That's what compassion is. It's my passion for you in your state of need. A Buddhist never thinks like that because passion of itself, whether it's a passion for a terrible thing or a passion for a good thing, are equally bad in a Buddhist framework. Because the arousal of the emotions is part of the problem. That's what keeps you here in the world, according to Buddha's theory. So in the Buddhist life, the practice of charity is not actually passion, a compassion, a love. It is actually the practice of non-self. It is my avoiding the belief that I have an enduring self. Anyway, none of that's in my notes, so I didn't really need to go there, other than to say it's interesting that Stoics had a very similar view. Yes, you act in a kind way toward others, but only by the mind. Was Julian an exception? Why do I go here? Because sometimes you will hear skeptics say, oh, I can give you a pagan emperor who started welfare in the pagan temples of Galatia. Pay yourself for this one, you know, because here's their sort of one opportunity where there is clear evidence of the imperial intention to establish, by a huge benefaction from Julian, a welfare system, caring for the poor, hostels for the sick. But I've given you the quotes from the original sources there at 1.6, and it will become crystal clear that the whole Julian program in the 4th century was designed to beat the Christians at their own game. In Julian's writings, he is worried that the Christians are about to take over the Roman world by the stealth of good works, by their constant love feasts, he calls them, their sort of open meals, their care for the graves of nobodies, their care for the poor. And in these two texts I've given you, he clearly says these despicable Galileans are winning the world through their kindness. It's despicable, he says. They care not only for their own poor, but for ours as well. And it's in that context, and that context only, friends, he gives the equivalent of millions of dollars to the pagan temples of Galatia to set up these welfare programs. He dies the next year, and the programs never go forward. Never go forward. And his worst nightmare also happened. Christianity took over the world by the stealth of good deeds. But Julian is a for me, a classic analogy of what you find a lot of atheists saying today. In reality, they are saying we want all of the Christian ethic without any of the Christian framework. Yeah? So you see Richard Dawkins' Ten Commandments of the Good Humanist, right? They're basically Judeo-Christian things, but he says any rational person will come to these. Okay, and he's not, in my view, he's not reflective enough on his history and the historical circumstances in which he lives to see that he actually thinks they are rational because of 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian culture. But here is Julian trying to do the works without the framework, and it collapses. I hardly need to turn at 1.7, 1.8 to the New Testament, the Old Testament and New Testament texts endorsing charity, do I? Is anyone going to have an argument with me over this? That the Bible says you've got to care for the poor. It doesn't matter whether they're deserving poor or undeserving poor. You care for the poor. Never be tight-fisted with the poor. All right. The other thing I thought I'd throw in at 1.9 is this claim you sometimes hear that Jesus' golden rule, do unto others as you have them do to you, was commonplace in the ancient world. Have you ever heard that? And what they're trying to do is relativize what Jesus said. Even if you found an exact parallel, you still got to ask the question, how come if you find a little sentence somewhere in some obscure ancient text that looks like what Jesus said, do you never find a movement that put it into practice? This is the interesting thing about the Stoic exception. You find in Cicero and Seneca really nice statements about being good to people. But were there Stoic hospitals, hospices, food programs? No. What about the golden rule? I went and checked up. Every time I found an author say, oh, Jesus' golden rule, do unto others as they have them do to you, is found in lots of other texts. Rabbi Hillel said it, Confucius said it, and so on. And then I went and found them, and I've printed them for you in your outlines. And the reality is, what you find is what could only be called a silver rule in other texts. You don't find do unto others as you'd have them do to you. You find don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. In each and every case that I've ever seen quoted. And here they all are. And Confucius speaks for them all. Here's Confucius' Analects. Because people will often say, oh, Confucius taught the same thing as Jesus. Well, yeah, sort of. Zigong asked, is there a single word such that one could practice it throughout one's life? In other words, what's the greatest commandment? The master said, reciprocity, perhaps. Do not inflict on others what you yourself would not wish done to you. Now, I want to say that's a nice close parallel, okay? And there's a Jewish example from Hillel's lips as well, a first century Jewish rabbi. But it is the negative form of the command. And it may well be that Jesus knew this negative form of the command, don't do it unto others is what you don't want them to do to you, and said, that's not good enough. Do to others what you would want them to do to you. Can you see how instantly, in just turning a few little words around, you have the difference between not causing someone harm and setting up hospitals for everyone? You see that? Then I've given you a couple of really nice examples, and you can, at 1:10, you can chase this later. I'm conscious that I'm not even going to get to science, am I? How long have I been going half my time, mate? I've been going half my time. All right. You know, for instance, just from a passing statement in Eusebius, where he quotes an earlier letter, just listing all the things that were going on in the Roman church in the year 250, that they were providing for 1,500 people on a food roster every day. Don't think Vatican, right? And they could afford it. This is the year 250. Things still aren't going very well for the church. And they are supporting daily 1,500 people. They uncovered a little church, 4th century church, in Turkey, and they found a storeroom underneath the church, 4th century, tiny little church, but they found something like 18 dresses, 35 slippers, 12 barrels of oil, 12 barrels of different stuff in a storehouse for a tiny little church. Why? For one reason. People flocked to churches and they gave them oil and, oh, you need slippers. We've got some slippers. You need some shirts. We have some shirts too. This is what the church did. It was in its blood. It knew that it had been saved by a gracious God who saw us in our wickedness but treated us with great love. And they said, we ought to look like that, not just believe it. I wish I had time to talk to you about St. Augustine and some newly discovered letters that he wrote. But I printed them, so I don't need to talk about them. But basically, in this letter to one of his fellow bishops, he reveals that the church of his period was rescuing slaves en masse, physically breaking into the quarters of press gangs and rescuing slaves and then feeding them to the point where they couldn't feed their... They had so many, they couldn't feed them. And he refers to case after case. And in one of the cases, he refers to them rescuing 120 people in one occasion. And he's writing this letter partly to say, we can hardly cope with the people we're rescuing. This notion that the church, you know, was just, you know, always into slavery until finally at the end, you know, it was overthrown is not really the historical picture. History is more like this than linear. There were periods where the church really did live by its doctrines of grace, and other periods where it defied them. Anyway, I just did tell you about Augustine's letter, and I said I don't have time to tell you about Augustine's letter. And then you know what I've done in the next little section? I've given you a whole bunch of quotes from non-Christian scholars, top-of-the-tree scholars, Rodney Stark, who I know is sort of flirting with Christianity, but he still claims not to be a Christian. Professor Jürgen Habermas, who's an atheist, and his comment about the influence of Judeo-Christian worldview on culture is amazing. And this is from a top-of-the-tree political philosopher. Peter Brown, professor of history at Princeton University. I can only imagine from the things he says about Christianity that he is not a practicing Christian, but along the way he tells us how amazing the early Christians were in their care of the poor. And then a couple of quotes from David Bentley Hart, who is a Christian, an Orthodox scholar, that will blow your mind in his wonderful little book, Atheist Delusions. Okay, here's my point, in case you fell asleep. This is wake-up time. What I'm saying is, you might be able to find a scrap here, a scrap there from ancient Greek and Roman writings that imply doing good things to poor people. But there were major worldview issues that prevented upsetting the rational order of the universe by stepping in and overturning someone's poverty. And the Christians inherited from their Jewish forebears and from the Old Testament itself the notion of caring for the poor, but they opened it to Jew and Gentile, believer and unbeliever alike. That was a novel thing in antiquity, a novel thing. And I'm not saying you should feel arrogant about this. I mean, this is one of those things where, you know, when I teach on this, it's a bit... I don't want you to run out there going, we own charity, ha, 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 right? But I do want you to feel confident in the historical argument that charity entered into Western consciousness because of Jesus. So did science. So did science. Probably the best thing I can do is show you a couple of snippets of interviews with leading scholars on this question, and then throw you to some important texts, and then maybe we'll have some questions. But it's interesting that the same doctrine of the eternal rational fixity of the world not only prevented charity, it actually prevented science as we know it. Yes, Aristotle and Plato were into rational reflection on the physical order, but science as we know it is about testing to see what is, not just about thinking what must be in accordance with rational order. I've shown you Edwin Judge before. He is Australia's most famous ancient historian, but everywhere I travel, when I say I'm from Macquarie University Ancient History Department, they say, oh, Edwin Judge. This man is incredibly significant. He's a very famous Augustus scholar, Emperor Augustus scholar, and then turned his attention to early Christianity as it grew up in the world of Augustus and Tiberius. We have a little interview with him on the question of science.
Edwin Judge is a distinguished scholar of Roman history and regarded as one of the most important social historians of early Christianity. In fact, in a recent volume of his collected works, the editor described Professor Judge as a turning point in scholarship and the new founder of what has come to be called the social scientific criticism of the New Testament. We at CPX are honoured to capture some key thoughts of this truly outstanding scholar.
Edwin, thanks for joining us. We're talking about Christianity and science, and I think it's fair to say today that Christianity is often cast as the enemy of science. But when we go back to the ancient world before Christianity, what would be considered science there?
Well, the word science simply means knowledge, and so the question is, how does one know things? And in our culture, this undoubtedly began with the Greeks in Ionia on the eastern seaboard of the Aegean Sea in the 6th century BC. And we don't know exactly the cause of this, but what happened was that a whole succession of philosophers started systematically analysing the phenomena they saw, working to explain the whole cosmos in a comprehensive definition. And they had very important starting points which were never challenged. It was never challenged, for example, that the cosmos was a material object. And everything in it, including the gods who were assumed to exist, was of material substance. So you had to say what the substances were, the essential substances, very much like particle physicists today, who are trying to find the ultimate physical reality of things. The Greeks were after this physics, meaning the essential substance. And they worked from a simple axiom, which we don't know who laid it down, but nobody challenged it. There were four elemental substances: earth, air, fire, and water. Mixtures of these four things and balances between them explained all phenomena, and they explained it by necessary logic. It was necessary because it was taken for granted that the whole cosmos was rational. That is, logic or rationality was the reigning principle of it. There was no flaw in it. Nothing was wrong about it. nor did anything change. Change was only an illusion, Parmenides said. It wasn't actually changing. And because that was a rather stiff challenge, his great successor Empedocles said, but what appear to be changes are in fact only cycles. Everything comes round eventually again and again. So the whole universe is in motion, all right, but not changing.
Again, a key text in this whole understanding of the ancient world is Plotinus and his view of the eternality, what comes around, what goes around, comes around. And so I'll skip over it because it's printed there for you. You can reflect on it. But the important thing is this, and I've put it up on the screen if you want to take down a key sentence. The doctrine of the eternality of the rational world not only curbed pity as an affront to the rational fixity of things, it hindered an empirical approach to science because it gave preeminence to rational reflection over and against crude observation and testing. The universe is infused with perfect logos, hence our minds are adequate to detect its true nature and workings. This is the ancient view of things. And I really would love you to try, and as difficult as this is, to imagine what it would be like to live in a world that where you thought that's all there was. That you could actually, through rational reflection, understand everything. Because you have a mind that is rational, that corresponds to the rationality of the universe. All I have to do in science is think, yeah? And do mathematical equations and ponder what ought to be the case. Another example of this comes from Galen, if you turn over the page to page 22. Galen was the second century medic, and he, in one text, criticizes Moses, what he means is the Jewish texts, for thinking that there is a God who is outside of the rational formative principle of the universe. And he criticizes Moses for thinking God could have made the world any way he liked. Can you see, for Galen, in his Greco-Roman view, even the gods are subject to rational principle. God couldn't just decide to make a human one particular way or another way, depending on his wish. And here we have the clash of two world views, and these are critical for understanding the origins of science. Here they are. The Greek worldview was this. Everything is subject to logos, thus it can be understood by our rational reflection. The Judeo-Christian worldview. Everything is contingent upon a free creator. In other words, it could have been different if the creator had wanted it to be. Thus, it can be understood by observing what is. Can you see the difference? See, if you really think everything in the universe is ordered according to a perfect logical pattern, then all you need to do is just think about it. You look at that and you go, I'm going to think about that problem. But if you think, actually, the universe might not operate by a perfectly logical, rational principle, it could be any way that God determined it to be, how do you get to understand it, therefore? By observing and testing. This is the insight that gives us the empirical method. Here's Edwin explaining again.
This is fascinating because I think at the moment there's a feeling in the culture that Christianity and science are at loggerheads. Are you suggesting that that's a very misplaced feeling?
Christianity, or above all the biblical doctrine of creation, is itself the creator of modern science, of the methodology of modern science. The whole business of testing for truth was explicitly rejected in classical culture as being illogical. It was illogical, specifically unrational, to test for truth. And so the impact of seeing the physical universe as an objective thing that could be analysed and explained for what it actually was and not what it in principle ought to have been, was very slow in coming. But the slow progress nevertheless represents the takeover of our worldview by the biblical perspective. We don't hold the Greek perspective anymore, in spite of the fact that people keep looking back to it as the origin of science. It's not the origin of science. The book of creation is the origin of modern science. The book of Genesis.
These ideas have been tested and worked on by one very significant scholar I introduce you to now. Peter Harrison is the Andreas Idrius Professor of Science and Religion at the University of Oxford. He has written two major books, very academic books, on the history of science. This is his area of expertise. One, the Bible and Protestantism, and the other, the Fall of Man and the Foundations of Science. Now, again, what I've done is I've taken the most significant paragraphs that will give you the guts of what he's saying, so that you can later go and reflect on this stuff, okay? But in short, he makes two arguments that are sort of additional to what you saw Edwin argue there. One, in the Protestant Reformation, as the Protestants began to fixate on the literal, historical meaning of the text instead of a dogmatic, logical approach to the Bible, he said that changed how people began to think about how one gains truth. You gain truth not by sitting back and thinking dogmatically. You gain truth by exploring, testing texts. And in the 17th century, people began to think, if you can do that with the book of God, that must also be the way you interrogate the book of nature. And in this, and he lays out all the sources from the origins of science so that you can see that this is actually how people were talking when science came about. That we interrogate nature literally, not dogmatically. We test it to find its meaning. We don't just sit back and logically pontificate. His next book, The Fall of Man, and I've given you the quotes from that as well, argues a very counterintuitive case. He says, you often hear people say it was when people gained great confidence in their rational thought that science was born in the 17th century. He says, there's no evidence of that. In fact, the evidence is the opposite. He said, it was the revival of St. Augustine's doctrine of the sinfulness of man in every part that gave rise to science. And here's how it goes. If you believe you have a full rational nature that hasn't been touched by sin, hasn't been blurred and corrupted and distorted, then you will think that you can think your way around the world without impairment, right? As soon as you believe that actually my rational nature has been impaired by sin, that I am fallen, not just morally but mentally, and this world itself is fallen, there is therefore no way you can rely on rationality to understand the world. You have to go out and test it. The only way to gain truth is to test it. And this, he argues, gave rise to modern science. Have a listen. You've published some very well-received books specifically arguing that there were a couple of themes in particular that gave rise to science. Mm-hmm. The Protestant approach to scripture being one. Mm. And the question of the fallenness mm-hmm. of humanity. Mm. Now, for those who aren't quite up on those things, could you give us an account of both of those things?
Yes. I think both of these are initially very counterintuitive, that you wouldn't expect that biblical literalism will promote a scientific approach to the world, and neither would you expect that a kind of very unfashionable doctrine that human beings are somehow fallen creatures is going to have an impact on science. But briefly, the relations or the connections go like this. But prior to the 17th century, prior to the modern period or prior to the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, when people approached the natural world, they read it in a symbolic way. And this symbolic way of reading was very closely tied with allegorical readings of scripture. When in the 16th and 17th centuries, Protestant reformers and to some extent humanist scholars moved towards a literal reading of scripture, an unintended consequence of this was a collapse of this symbolic world order, a symbolic way of reading the world. And the collapse of this symbolic way of reading the world made possible new mathematical readings of nature. And one clear way to think about this is to think about the classic metaphor of the two books, and that is the idea that God had written two books, the book of Scripture and the book of nature. And what we find happening in the 16th and 17th centuries is that new approaches to the book of Scripture, new approaches to reading the book of Scripture, actually end up prompting new approaches to reading the book of nature. And one of those ways is a scientific way of reading the world. And we find quite explicitly in people like Galileo, who deploy this book of nature metaphor, he wants to argue, well, actually now we read the book of nature not in a symbolic way, but we read it for its mathematical intelligibility.
And the fallenness of humanity, how does that relate?
Yes, now the fallenness of humanity is an interesting one. It's very clear that a presupposition for science is an assumption of the rational intelligibility of the world, and I think that's been known for some time. My view is that more than this, we need not simply to assume that the world is in some way mathematical and rationally constructed, because that assumption alone leads us to believe that we can intuit the nature of the world directly.
That was Aristotle's view, wasn't it?
Precisely. Aristotle has a view that naturally our minds are attuned to how nature is, and we don't need to do a lot of work. And, you know, thus, for example, we assume that feathers fall at the same rate as hammers because that's what we see. It's a common sense approach. What we find in the 17th century is a kind of counterintuitive approach to the natural world. And I argue that this counterintuitive approach is prompted by two beliefs. Firstly, that the human mind has fallen away from its original condition, and that as a consequence of the fall, the things that have happened to our mind need to be overcome in particular ways. And what we find people saying in the 17th century is that the imperfections of the human mind that resulted from the fall can be overcome in part if we engage in communal scientific practices, if we engage in experiments where we interrogate nature very closely, if we engage in long-scale scientific activities where we accumulate knowledge over time and we have a probabilistic account of what we can know. So it's actually the idea that our minds are limited in what they can know that prompts the whole experimental approach to the natural world. And the other element of this is that nature itself has fallen away from an original transparency to our intellect, so that the world is not as it once was, and therefore we need to interrogate it experimentally in order to extract information from it.
I know these are huge ideas, perhaps complicated, but the at least what you have in your outline enables you to dig deeper as you wish, reflect longer. But the punchline is this, friends: you can hold your head high in the confidence that two of the apparently self-evident societal goods in the Western world derive directly from the biblical worldview. Charity and science. Thank you.